It's a very small sample there of the heart-rendering, almost melancholic theme by Michael Nyman, of course, for Tomorrow, from the original soundtrack to Gattaca, which, of course, is at the heart of the latest edition of the Culture Shapers. I think we've decided we'll settle on that as opposed to the Culture Makers. We'll talk about the shaping of culture, some of the classic science fiction films that have been produced over the years and which we're privileged to actually share with some experts within the field, directorial, behind the scenes, production-based things, writers and so on. Today, a clear friend of the Culture Shapers, and one day he will come back to Britain, I'm sure. We welcome director of such delights as Spectres, The Truth Is Out There, and a whole heap of other classic things, Phil Leonis. Welcome to the Culture Shapers.
Thanks for having me back, Alex, and indeed I think it should be, at least for the purposes of discussing today's movie Gattaca, it should be Culture Shaper rather than Culture Maker, because, of course, as the opening, one of the opening quotes alludes to in Gattaca, we are supposed to tamper with Mother Nature because Mother wants us to. So indeed, we may not have made nature, but we shape it.
Indeed. Gregor Mendel didn't realise what he was setting off in his time, and as far as Darwin's concerned, a different line. I always found this particular movie quite a fascinating exploration. It's actually one of the newer texts that we've actually considered over the series, and we kind of thought, well, deliberately, it was one of those things which clearly is at the forefront of the Genome Project, the Human Genome Project. Gattaca itself is actually an acronym of guanine, adenosine, thymine, cytosine, the four basic ribonucleic and nucleic acid pairs that effectively make all of life on Earth, as far as we currently perceive reality. But I'm particularly fascinated to come first, Phil, to your good self, as a filmmaker. How did you find the approach that Andrew Niccol actually took on this? Because his background, The Truman Show, Simone, he's always, I feel, very much is in this science fiction field. Did it work for you, good self? Because I mean, the thing I always like about it, again, is that it takes away with the kind of shiny suits, large spaceships and all the other factors, and really focuses on the human condition heavily.
Well, I was actually impressed by where Andrew seemed to be taking his cues, you know, his thematic cues, because I'd never seen Gattaca before we decided that we were going to talk about this. I'd of course seen The Truman Show and Simone, and he struck me as one of a handful of filmmakers who, quite rightly, at that point in time, the late 90s, was for some reason quite obsessed by Patrick McGoohan's The Prisoner. There were no shortage of science fiction films in the late 90s, early 2000s, The Matrix comes to mind, where there are overt and subtextual references to The Prisoner. But in this, he seems very much to be taking his cues from Aldous Huxley's Brave New World. And as I speak about with my podcast co-host and a contributor to Culture Shapers, Dean Haglund, who is a huge fan as well of Aldous Huxley and of Brave New World, it's really quite, I don't know if relief is the right word, but it's pleasing that the discussions that are brought up through Huxley in both that and his book of essays, Brave New World Revisited, are finding their way into contemporary stories. Because you're right, they are about rather eternal human questions of philosophy.
Or indeed, to look at the name of the lead character, Freeman questions. We have Vincent Freeman and, of course, his brother, Anton Freeman. I love the Gore Vidal character.
Which I guess could be a Prisoner reference.
It could, indeed. Yes.
There you go again, Conrad, I guess.
But also the character Gore Vidal, who is Director Joseph, and the slight Germanic theme there, because it seems to not only riff on the Brave New World, all those Huxley references, but it also surely takes the boys from Brazil, it takes the fear notion of genetically designed life forms coming together. It takes this control factor, and again, the very real sense that if you actually applied the kind of high criteria to selecting the right genetic makeup, probably you would have not allowed Albert Einstein because he was dyslexic. You would have clearly taken out Abraham Lincoln because of a variety of issues. There were a whole range of sort of issues here, and that line about there is no gene for the human spirit. On the one level, it kind of resonates with the notion that actually it's the imperfection that actually makes the perfection. And I think that was, for me, one of the aspects of the film, that you have this apparently perfect society and you have a lot of visual references. I mean, we're going to allude to this as this particular discussion develops, but for me, one of the classic references was Jude Law's character when he has to crawl up the double helical staircase and that ascension of man almost from the bottom to the top to actually effectively rescue and provide an alibi for Vincent Freeman. There are lots of sort of metaphorical visual cues that I thought, you know, Nickel is to be credited with, because I suspect maybe one or two of them were accidental, but possibly one or two were also deliberately structured in part of the as part of the narrative.
Well, I think I don't know if there's any such thing as accident. I mean, the best artists visually are, you know, plumbing their unconscious. They're shining a light into their unconscious, and so the full meaning of these visuals might not be apparent to them in terms of a reading of the text, but nor should they be. When you're making a film, you are very much the designer on the inside of a structure who has to lean out the window at the end and say, how does it look? Good? Okay, now can you tell me what I built? Because you're building it from the inside out, and you don't get to see the finished piece. You still see all the individual pieces that have been attached together. I think you're right about that, the symbol of Jude Law's character climbing up. And for me, one of the main themes of this film is something that is quite popular and used, that I use to explain the great appeal of the Marvel superhero universe in movies versus, let's say, the DC universe. In recent years, namely this theme that our imperfections, our woundings are what will heal us. Our greatness will come from our weaknesses. This is true in so many of the Marvel superhero characters, and it's true of the main in Gattaca. You know, it explores the idea that greatness requires limitations to push off against in order to achieve its full expression, its full exploration. Without limitations put upon it, greatness isn't even possible.
I mentioned Gore Vidal's casting, and Gore obviously had a lot to say, quite critically about the American state of affairs and so on. But equally, characters that were brought in, Uma Thurman, and I think at this particular stage in her career, although obviously she met her future husband, Ethan Hawke, as a result of Gattaca, Batman and Robin had obviously sort of manifested, and Poison Ivy, and that had done. And clearly there was the Avengers, in which she took on board the mantle of Emma Peel. She seemed to basically be making movie choices that sort of kind of worked, but then didn't kind of work. And Gattaca, again, it wasn't a blockbuster hit, but it resonates. It provokes thought. Needless to say, I have to give a mention to somebody who I've always been keen ever since his days in Airwolf and, of course, beyond, Ernest Borgnine as Caesar. Again, not sure whether that's a reference to the role that Caesar was given in Conquest of the Planet of the Apes, of basically being a janitor and so on, and Borgnine sort of addressing that whole system. Alan Arkin as Detective Hugo. Was that a reference to the kind of Victor Hugo notion of Inspector Gerard and the
right.
One person who continues working on that basis? Lots of little layers.
I like the reference to those two actors that you mentioned, character actors who are we still think of, no matter how relevant Alan Arkin is today, and of course he is, but you still think of them as really character actors from a bygone era. And I think it's so interesting that in his later career, Ernest Borgnine did make a mark in science fiction, but always playing very much a blue-collar everyman, like the head of the janitors in Gattaca. Mm. How about the taxi cab driver in Escape from New York?
Indeed.
It's almost as if there was a commentary and awareness on the part of the filmmakers and the casting people that where Hollywood itself was heading, the only place for blue-collar everyman was now going to be in the world of science fiction. Because in our quote-unquote realistic movies, we want superheroes. And so it's ironic to find someone who, Marty, you know, Ernest Borgnine was the ultimate everyman in the Oscar-winning Marty. And here he is bringing that same kind of embodiment to a future world.
You mentioned the...
And Uma Thurman. Oh, and I was just going to say about Uma Thurman, when I heard you describing, you know, some of her choices and how, really, although Gattaca was not a hit, it really did kind of cement an idea of Uma Thurman. And it reminds me of my friend who I've worked with, Tucker Smallwood, who, when he was going through a dry spell as an actor, not being cast in things, people said, well, it's just because we look around the world and we don't see black men like you in different walks of life. Until one person finally said, ah, but maybe the future will have black people like you. And so suddenly this huge career opened up for him in science fiction. And I feel like with Uma Thurman, it was like no one knew exactly where she fit. Oh, I've got it. The future. And it really does resonate.
And one could certainly say Irene Cassini, which also carries with it resonances of astrophysics and telescopes and the Cassini views, etc., also addresses that. You mentioned Dean Haglund, of course, a mutual friend, colleague, much essential part of the Chilpack Hollywood weekly podcast package, even though he is in Australia. We obviously shared with Dean his views on Metropolis. Could it be said that this movie, from one perspective, could be seen as a much cleaner version of Metropolis, but in which you still have that kind of overclass, underclass, except it's a class that's clearly much more controlled. It's a way of actually using the science to control its beings. Because ultimately, if you know from when you're literally born, and you can take through a droplet of blood exactly when you're going to die, you've got that level of precision, which scientists will still say, yes, it's getting there, or it's possible, it does actually happen. Doesn't that also lead, maybe another Prisoner reference, to information? We want information, and that information about individuals on a genetic level is essentially all to do with that battle of the individual against society. And I realise, actually, Phil, here I'm kind of talking more and more around the notion of, well, actually, what Andrew Niccol did with Gattaca was simply rework The Prisoner, but in a slightly more sterile environment.
Well, I'm not sure. I see where I see it as being very free of the Prisoner is that, you know, if The Prisoner's ultimate theme is, you know, to explore the right of the individual to be individual, it's very hard to make the stretch that is what Gattaca is exploring. This is about the right of the individual to do whatever he has to fit into the collective so that he might pursue a dream. You know, it's very much about how he must fit in, and he's right to try to fit in. It's an idea that you achieve your full aims by participating in the system. And I think that Patrick McGoohan and his collaborators would argue with that to a great degree. I also think that, you know, an idea about nature versus nurture, you know, you have those opening quotes to which I alluded, the one from Ecclesiastes about God's handiwork and design, and then the one from Willard Galen about tampering with Mother Nature, and this interesting idea of nature versus nurture, this counterpoint between dad and mom, that will then play out in, I want to call him Jerome, but the character's real name is not Jerome. It's Vincent.
Vincent.
Is Vincent
indeed
his name?
Vincent, yeah. Freeman.
Yeah, and that'll play out, obviously, right? Because it's the mother's desire that it be a natural birth, a normal birth versus the father's, you know, sneaking suspicion that is all too quickly realized that it should have been a valid birth. So there is this dichotomy between mother and father in it. So these are all such universal human ideas, you know, being torn between the faith in us our mothers have versus the ideas for us that our fathers might have, that are, you know, is entirely a different terrain than, again, something like The Prisoner was interested in exploring.
We've talked about the narrative, and we will return to the narrative, but part of the cinematic delight, really, is actually really soaking into the whole atmosphere. I mean, I think you alluded to in a recent podcast for Chilpack Hollywood Hour how what we see on the screen are ghosts, they're living ghosts, they are manifestations of what it's like to be alive in times past. Cinemas themselves are time machines that you can actually go into in terms of the theatre. And the name Sławomir Idziak, born in 1945 in Katowice, Poland, cinematographer and director, who, as well as doing Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix and Black Hawk Down, was at the heart of Gattaca. I thought that the line, it was a very clean movie in so many ways, and I think somehow maybe it worked from a future perspective because of the way that we were seeing an antiseptic environment. We didn't see a great deal of dirt that was actually there. I mean, the only dirt that you possibly had was the self-created dirt and so on. Some might say it was sterile, some might say it was completely antiseptic and so on. But did you think that Idziak, from your view as a professional filmmaker, did he manage to encapture the visual image that we see effectively?
Oh, absolutely. I think that's the strength of the film. In fact, you mentioned Metropolis earlier, and here is clearly a film that is exploring terrain of Metropolis. There are, I believe, a few shots that are automatic visual references to Metropolis, and as well as Blade Runner. So much of, obviously, science fiction of the last 35 years does owe a debt to Blade Runner, and there are visual references to that as well, some of the noirish, the Art Deco, you know, references. The amusing to me now, it's so funny, ever since it was pointed out to me, that if you see modern architecture, i.e. architecture in the modernist movement from the 1950s. If you see that in a film, you know someone duplicitous or evil lives there. It's so strange that a movement that was very utopian in its ideal, an architecture movement that was utopian in its ideal, would almost always house the villainous among us. And that's used to great visual effect in this movie as well. I don't have a problem with the antiseptic look of the film. I love that it, almost from the time it's made, is, like Blade Runner, a time capsule of the way the past looked at the future. Look at the computer screens that they're working on. Nobody had ever thought just a few years hence we'd have HD and plasma screens, and not only that we would have them, but because we now had this great resolution, all our screens, be they computer monitors or television, would be in the rectangular widescreen format of movies. No, here's Gattaca telling us that the future is going back to tube screens that are 1:3:3 in format. So there's one way of looking at it, which is it's outdated, but again, it seems to me that it is a knowing nod of the cap to the way the past looked at the future.
We talked about good character actors. It would be remiss of us not to mention Xander Berkeley as Dr. Lamar, who has emerged in a variety of roles in a number of genre movies as well. Did that also help the film actually having a range? I mean, we mentioned clearly Gore Vidal, we mentioned the other characters that were based within that. I mean, somebody like Xander Berkeley playing somebody who clearly is working for the system, he's part of the system, but ultimately knows. We realise that actually he knows all along that he was dealing with Vincent, with an invalid as opposed to a valid in terms of that system. Does that kind of also lead the viewer or the audience to the notion that actually at least there's hope. I mean, I did feel at the heart of this movie was very much a positive message. I mean, in previous Culture Shaper discussions we've had, Phil, we've talked about space opera, we've talked about 2001: A Space Odyssey, we've talked about Forbidden Planet and so on. This is that sort of notion that actually keeping hold of that hope and maintaining that optimism is so critical to really our very own survival, with one exception, which I thought was really hard to take, and watching it again, I still found it a very powerful and slightly depressing scene, the end of Jude Law's character and the final sort of the intercut between the ship going up and obviously the furnace scene, which I don't know. I would have been very tempted to say, did we need that? But maybe we did. Maybe there was a resolution of a fashion there.
Well, it starts there also, because Ethan Hawke's character is burning himself at the beginning. You know, when we see, before we hear his backstory that he narrates for us in an unfortunate, to me, narrative choice, instead of
just like Blade Runner before they did the director's cut, of course.
Yeah. It gives us way too much. But the if you'll recall, it begins with Vincent/Jerome exfoliating and burning his own genetic materials, and so that sets up that ending. Obviously, we know that the real Jerome needs to end up in there. But I would say this: I want to talk about the work of casting director Francine Maisler. She is one of the greats, and this movie, you know, you mentioned Xander Berkeley. I mean, what an important character, obviously, from a narrative perspective, that turns out to be. The wonderful plant of, I need to tell you about my son someday. And, you know, in hoping that that will pay off, but also hoping that it won't pay off in any kind of real plot way. He does become an important element of the plot, and the story of the son is his motivation, but it's not something like a clue that will solve the mystery. So it's really a beautiful character piece and a wonderful actor to do it. Because even when Xander Berkeley plays villains, which he does so well, one of the reasons he does them so well is he's recognizably human. And that's the thing about the supporting cast in this. The world might be sterile, the world might be antiseptic, but there's an astonishing amount of humanity in the part of so many of these characters. And Francine Maisler does a remarkable job of casting people from a variety of different backgrounds. In one of the first roles that I've seen him in, Dean Norris plays a police officer who gets shamed by Jude Law's character. Dean Norris would finally go on to achieve great notoriety and acclaim as one of the stars of Breaking Bad 10 years later, and she's found him already. Two wonderful sketch comedians have very bit parts. Ken Marino has a part where he plays one of the functionaries at the lab where you can come in and take prospective romantic matches genetic samples to have them tested to see how good a potential match they are for producing offspring. He plays the clerk there. Saturday Night Live alumnus and brilliant character actress Maya Rudolph plays the nurse that delivers Vincent. So every single one of these roles is cast with such care, often with people who are going to go on to huge careers. And the reason I keep wanting to get back to this is because clearly it was important to them that humanity brim around the edges of this so that there can be exactly what you're describing, a sense of hope. Because the ultimate takeaway is that the system that's been allowed to be created is inhuman, but the people populating it still have their humanity, still have their heart, and that means there's hope. And indeed, maybe this is the reason we're talking about this movie 18 years later, because maybe there's some resonance to that as we think of systems that seem to be doing their darndest to dehumanize us. And yet, everywhere you look, you can find the flowering of humanity at its best.
It's become almost a cliche of mine that I often use the Bible as being the first epic science fiction adventure, even if you take it as an acronym for Basic Instruction Booklet for the Life Experience. Well, here we have the tale of the brothers, clearly Cain and Abel, and yet not quite. We do have the two brothers there. We have Anton, we have Vincent, we have that connection. We have the leaving of home from Vincent, where he actually tears his particular head, literally the photograph of his head, away from the family picture, and the from that. Does that also resonate with the notions of ultimately the kind of trials that Vincent obviously goes through as a boy, or the challenges? Because curiously, ultimately his brother, we kind of left it clearly, he's become fairly successful as Anton. He's become a detective. He's worked through that. He recognises in his brother. He works very much together with Detective Hugo to solve the crime, the murder of overall director of the actual sort of institute. Does that also work, that kind of the battle between brothers? I mean, we saw it obviously with respect to Data and Law in Star Trek: The Next Generation, the kind of the battle of brothers and so on.
I think it all does come back to this idea of innate humanity. I think Inspector Hugo, we're not given any reason to believe that Inspector Hugo is anything other than a faith birth, right? Because of his age, and also because even despite his age and his experience, he works for Lauren Dean's Anton character. So Alan Arkin's Inspector must be what we would call normal folk in our parlance, and yet he's one of the really, I won't say ugly characters, but he seems to embrace the idea that he has a good life so long as he keeps the boot heel on those who are genetically like himself. It's a kind of ugly character. Yes, indeed, ultimately he outs one of the powerful elite. But for a lot of it, we see a man who seemed to take joy in persecuting the people he is genetically like. The other ugly character is the real Jerome. He has this certain sense of entitlement that he has to live up to, that has destroyed his humanity. And that ultimately is why the ending for him, I think, is appropriate, because it's this action that probably allows him to reclaim his humanity, birth through death, rebirth through death. In terms of the brothers, it's fascinating to me. I have great compassion for the Anton detective character, because what's interesting is he has no choice. By being a designed birth, he is told from the outset, you are better than your brother, you are expected to be better than your brother, you have to be better than your brother has to be less than you, which leaves very little room for someone to love their brother. And yet, ironically, it is Vincent, it is the faith birth, who chooses to reject his brother after saving him. So it's really interesting that Anton ultimately is given a choice of whether or not to be his brother's keeper, a choice that he has been denied most of his life by not being a faith birth. Does that make sense, what I'm getting at?
It does, and I think the other aspect, of course, is the brotherly feelings, to a large extent, that Jude Law's Jerome Eugene Morrow, to give him his full title, and again, I think we see an interesting line there in terms of the middle name, and his relationship with the character of Vincent, because there is certainly something that grows, and even from the moment when Vincent is effectively about to chuck the whole thing in and say, that's it, we've got to go, it's all over. It's actually the character of Jude Law's Jerome Morrow that effectively says, no, you've got to keep going. You've got to stick at it. Don't just turn away when it looks as though suddenly you're going to be revealed or outed.
Right. The ability to find our own meaning in helping others achieve, which seems to be a concept for which the world that is being designed in Gattaca seems to leave little space for. that idea. And it kind of gets back to this, you know, this idea of the flaws and the weakness in humanity being the source of the meaning of humanity. I, as you know, teach acting, and one of the things I remind actors again and again, because it can be a very tough profession for a variety of reasons, but one of the reasons is that you often are plunged into a kind of despair, a kind of sadness, whether it be feelings of your own or feelings that are coming forward from the character that you're playing. But for whatever reason, you find yourself plunged into a sadness and a despair that you know you can never communicate to anyone. And it leaves you feeling very alone. And I remind these actors that those times are so important because we can't, as a people, compare our accomplishments. What gives me a sense of pride is not going to be the same thing that gives you a sense of pride, just like we can't compare joy. But we all experience sadness and despair and isolation. So the irony is, when we're experiencing those feelings, we're actually more closely connected to the rest of humanity than at any other time, the times we feel most alone. As Joseph Campbell would say, you know, it's the purpose of the individual to save society, not the reverse. And we save it not in the moments of our tribe's great victories, but in the silences of our personal despair. And the world of Gattaca and the world of the designed births does not allow for those moments. In fact, it's trying to program those out. But Jude Law, through an accident that we find out was not quite an accident, is plunged into that kind of despair, and in it finds his connection to humanity and indeed his potential salvation, which is helping another achieve their bliss, as Joseph Campbell would say.
We've discussed the set, we've discussed the look of the film. We started off by considering very briefly the music. We're going to turn to that now for a second, if we may, Phil, because 4 years before Gattaca, the electrifying score for the piano, of course, with Holly Hunter, really brought Michael Nyman, British composer, to the fore, certainly with respect to piano music. This is what we actually opened the piece with. It is performed by Joo Hyun Park. Just have a little listen to this extract from the score of Gattaca, and just sort of share with us your sort of thoughts after we've listened to it about how effective this is. And again, not just acting to minimalise or in a sort of minimalistic way approach sort of some of the emotive elements, but really maybe actually impacting on something which maybe a full orchestral John Williams score possibly wouldn't have. Thank you. Speaking of somebody who always enjoys the music of Eric Satie and Debussy in terms of French Impressionist music, and also quite likes to play it every so often, I thought that was a really emotive force. Presumably designed for a 12-fingered pianist, played by Ryan Doran.
Oh, you took the words out of my mouth. That kind of virtuosity would require 12 fingers, which is an interesting moment, isn't it? What we would consider a mutation, a defect, having an extra finger on each hand, of course, becomes a gift for one's unique virtuosity. But you'd have a hard time thinking that someone designed someone that way. I don't know. Anyway, but I think, yes, the sparse music is so important in terms of, again, making this a film about an individual's quest. And I must say, if I'm allowed, as you know, on my weekly show, Dean and I don't like to deal strictly in the positive. And so if I might take this film to task and suggest a reason why, for all its hopefulness, it has not managed to gain the same cultural traction as so many more dystopian views of its era and of the 1980s. And it is the fact that so much of the film's look and sound is designed in such a way to make this an individual story. The way we get to share Jerome / Vincent's terror when he takes his contact lenses out in a tunnel seen in Blade Runner and in The Terminator leading into downtown Los Angeles. And he has to jaywalk in that harrowing scene across the street. And we're tied with his point of view. It's very much about being tied with his pursuit of his dream. And yet, that ultimately is the undoing of the film because narratively he's given us everything in that 20-minute monologue. And the rest of the film is pretty much just us watching the clock to see the week that goes by before he gets on that rocket launch. Everything in the film is B story. There is no A story because there are no obstacles that he must solve through his own revelation of character. It might have behooved the filmmakers to make him need to solve the murder of the superior before they get to him, knowing that that investigation will lead to his being outed. Perhaps he should have taken it upon himself to try to solve the case, and through the solving of it, we learn his backstory. That might have helped make this film resonate more, because we are supposed to be tied with him, his point of view, and caring about him. So indeed, he needed to be really, if you will, the detective character. And each clue reveals something about himself.
An interesting perspective. Again, from the point of view of the world, and almost a William Blake philosophy here, the notion of the world, the universe, in a grain of sand, or indeed a lock of hair. I did sort of like the resonance that we got for both Uma Thurman's character and Ethan Hawke's character within that whole system. Let's talk a little bit about Ethan Hawke, because we haven't mentioned really his own role and performance within that. Before this, of course, I was really familiar with him not only for his role within Dead Poets Society, but also, more importantly, for the double act, obviously, with Julie Delphi in Before Sunrise and then Before Sunset, and that sort of element, which I thought was really wonderful sort of duologue that sort of works from that perspective. What about yourself, Phil? Did you sort of think, we've talked about, obviously, the casting of the character actors are working well. Did Ethan suit the role from the viewer's perspective, or from the director's perspective, wearing your directorial hat?
Fun that you would say suit it. I find it so delightful that these business suits that they wear is indeed his astronaut outfit going out into space. Yeah. Is still one of these business suits. He's a very interesting actor in that he's not personality based in any way, if you know what I mean. It is his performances are never based on personal idiosyncrasies, and we had really come through an era in film where personal idiosyncrasies were quite championed, and so he's perfect for something like this, where obviously it's about eliminating the personal idiosyncrasies to be able to pass in a world in which you do not belong. It's about adopting, you know, one of the fun things for me is to, you know, no one recognizes him. No one recognizes him because, of course, he looks so different. It's almost a Clark Kent Superman thing.
The
where
kiss
all it
curl
takes
is everything.
Glasses.
The glasses on the kiss curl.
And yeah, well, parting, remember Christopher Reeve parted his hair on opposite sides when he was Superman or Clark Kent. And so it's so amusing that no one recognizes him. But it does strike you the truth that exists in this world, not only the world of Gattaca, that if you embody the energy of someone who belongs, no one will question you because deep down we're all terrified that we don't belong. And Ethan Hawke does a wonderful job of that as an actor. In all those films that you mentioned, think about how different, or the recent Boyhood, think about how many different energies Ethan Hawke embodies in Boyhood, because as we know, that film was shot over a period of at least a decade. They would get back
it's
together.
It's the film
for a
you always wanted to make,
year.
Phil. We know. It's the film you were had in
well,
mind.
Well, yeah, but... But what a remarkable job that he does, letting himself embody physically a different character as he aged, and the energy changes so much. And so when you think about Dead Poets Society, when you think about Gattaca, you think about the movies with Julie Delpy, the energy he embodies is specific to that character. It is not Ethan Hawke bringing a set of Ethan Hawke mannerisms or idiosyncrasies. So he really is, to me, a throwback almost to the era of actors like a Glenn Ford, rather than the modern movie stars who get so celebrated and so recognizable for what they bring to each role.
The tagline, "There is no gene for the human spirit," still resonates in the hind end of the 20th century as it does in the first two decades of the 21st century. But we'll perhaps leave this particular discussion with the line that effectively we see uttered by Ethan Hawke as he heads off into, obviously, or heading off to Titan. "For someone who was never meant for this world, I must confess I'm suddenly having a hard time leaving it. Of course, they say every atom in our bodies was once part of a star. Maybe I'm not leaving. Maybe I'm going home." From my own perspective, Phil, that actually, again, is one of the joys of the film, because it does remind us that we are star stuff, that actually we do connect on a level that, despite all of the apparent schisms and differences of opinion that we actually have in the world, despite all the apparent oppositions and so on, you know, ultimately there is this notion that if you stay true to your dream, and you cited obviously Joseph Campbell and Hero of a Thousand Faces and the relevance within that, that's what for me lifts this particular narrative into something which really does demonstrate that, yeah, there is always a way. Sometimes we don't think there is, but there is always a way.
Well, I love we've talked about so many of the characters, but we haven't talked about the character of the car, the 1963 Avanti Studebaker that he drives. And I love that all the cars are 1960s in their model, updated for the electric fuel source of the era in which Gattaca takes place. But it's such a specific choice, is it not? 1963 convertible. And what was happening in 1963, some 25 years almost before Gattaca comes out?
The dream of Kennedy.
Well, the first thing that comes to mind is the dream of Kennedy. We will put a man on the moon before the end of the decade. And that kind of hope that died with the death of Kennedy on November 22, 1963, in a convertible. And did I mention that November 22nd, 1963, was also the day that Aldous Huxley died? Mm. And I think that this is another wonderful, knowing production design references to the thematic implications of the film itself. Before we go, Alex, I love when, as you know, art imitates life, but I also love equally as much when life imitates art. And a terrific young actor at the time, Lauren Dean, who was ubiquitous, really, at the time. He would do so many movies. And one of my favorite performances of his was in Space Cowboys, the Clint Eastwood movie. And he was everywhere for a long time. And he has not acted, as far as I can tell, on screen in any way, big or small, cinematic or television, episodic, since at least 2010, 2011 might have been the last time. He's vanished. And I can't find information about what happened to him. But what you can find is apparently Lauren Dean, Inspector Anton, found himself in very much a real Gattaca because his identity was stolen from him. And there's and if you research that, there's some very interesting stories about someone who took Lauren Dean's identity and what they did with it.
Absolutely. It was a question we were going to comment on, but as you rightly said, we have the basic here. Our notion, he was in Enemy of the State, Apollo 13, Gattaca, and then suddenly...
Apollo 13. Terrific character work.
Phil, as ever, a delight. I think we've hopefully shaped a bit of culture as we continue on this ongoing saga of working our way through a whole variety of aspects. Thank you once again for joining us. A reminder, you can also download all of the Culture Shapers series from southsidebroadcasting.podbean.com, and we'll probably rerun this over Easter as well.
Might I issue a warning, though, to those who are listening who are thinking of a career as an astronaut. Please don't lie or try to cover up any investigations into the health of your heart. Because indeed, something that the space program has always screened out. If you have heart defects, you are screened out from participating as an astronaut with good reason, because they cannot keep you safe up there, and you will be jeopardizing the entire mission. So that is one place in which I have a hard time feeling the sympathy with Vincent in the movie.